Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Chapter 13, Part 1 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Neath Iron Wheels, Part 1. Side by side, they leaned over the rail of the steamer and gazed shoreward at the slowly unfolding scene before them. For some time, they had all preserved an almost ecstatic silence. "But it's good to see home again," Laura sighed at last. "I'm with you," Quest agreed emphatically. "It's the wrong side of the continent, perhaps, but I'm aching to set my foot on American soil again." "This the wrong side of the continent? I should say not," Laura exclaimed, pointing to where in the distance the buildings of the exposition gleamed almost snow-white in the dazzling sunshine. "Why, I've never seen anything so beautiful in my life." The professor intervened amiably. His face, too, shone with pleasure as he gazed landwards. "I agree with the young lady," he declared. "The blood and sinews of life may seem to throb more ponderously in New York. But there is a big life here on this western side, a great, wide-flung, pulsating life. There is room here, room to breathe." "And it is so beautiful," Lenora murmured. Quest glanced a little away along the deck to where a pale-faced man stood leaning upon his folded arms, gazing upon the same scene. There was no smile on Craig's face, no light of anticipation in his eyes. "I guess there's one of us here," Quest observed, "who is none too pleased to see America again." Lenora shivered a little. They were all grave. "We must, I think, admit," the professor said, "that Craig's deportment during the voyage has been everything that could be desired. He has even voluntarily carried out certain small attentions to my person, which I must confess that I had greatly missed." "That's all right," Quest agreed. "At the same time, I'm afraid the moment has come now to remind him that the end is drawing near." Quest moved slowly down the deck towards Craig's side and touched him on the arm. "Give me your left wrist, Craig," he said quietly. The man slunk away. There was a sudden look of horror in his white face. He started back, but Quest was too quick for him. In a moment, there was a click of a handcuff, the mate of which was concealed under the criminologist's cuff. "You'd better take things quietly," the latter advised. "It will only hurt you to struggle. Step this way a little. Put your hand in your pocket, so, and no one will notice." Craig obeyed silently. They stepped along the deck towards the rest of the party. Lenora handed her glasses to Quest. "Do look, Mr. Quest," she begged. "There is Inspector French standing in the front row on the dock, with two enormous bunches of flowers, carnations for me, I expect, and poinsettias for Laura. They're the larger bunch." Quest took the glasses and nodded. "That's French, right enough," he assented. "Look at him standing, straightening his tie, in front of that advertisement mirror. Flowers, too. Say, he's got his eyes on one of you girls. Not you, by any chance, is it, Lenora?" Lenora laughed across at Laura, who had turned a little pink. "I guess French has got some sense enough to know I'm not that sort," the latter replied. "The double harness stuff doesn't appeal to me, and he knows it." Lenora made a little grimace as she turned away. "Well," she said, "it's brave talk." "Almost," the professor pointed out, "Amazonian. Yet, in the ancient days, even the Amazons were sometimes tamed." "Oh, nonsense," Laura exclaimed, turning away. "I don't see why the man wants to make himself Looked like a walking conservatory, though. She added under her breath. And I think it's sweet of him, Lenora insisted. If there's anything I'm longing for, it's a breath of perfume from those flowers. Slowly the great steamer drifted nearer and nearer to the dock. Hats were waved from the little line of spectators. Ropes were drawn taut. The inspector was standing at the bottom of the gangway as they all passed down. He shook hands with everyone vigorously. Then he presented Lenora with her carnations and Laura with the poinsettias. Lenora was enthusiastic. Even Laura murmured a few words of thanks. Some flowers, those poinsettias, the inspector agreed. Quest gripped him by the arm. French, he said, I tell you, I shall make your hair curl when you hear all that we've been through. Do you feel like having me start in right away or on our way to the cars? French withdrew his arm. Nothing doing, he replied. I want to talk to Miss Laura. You can stow the criminal stuff. It'll wait all right. You've got the fellow. That's what matters. Quest exchanged an amused glance with Lenora. The inspector and Laura fell a little behind. The former took off his hat for a moment and fanned himself. Say, Miss Laura, he began, I'm a plain man and a poor hand at speeches. I have been saying a few nice things over to myself on the dock here for the last hour, but everything's gone right out of my head. Look here, it sums up like this. How do you feel about quitting this bunch right away, coming back to New York with me? Why do I want to go to New York for? Laura demanded. Oh, come on, Miss Laura. You know what I mean, French replied. We'll slip off and get married here, and then take this man Craig to New York. Once we get him safely in the tombs, and we'll go off on a honeymoon anywhere you say. Laura was on the point of laughing at him. Then the unwonted seriousness of his expression appealed suddenly to her sympathy. She patted him kindly on the shoulder. You're a good sort, Inspector, but you've picked the wrong girl. I've run on my own hook ever since I was born, I guess, and I can't switch my ideas over to this married stuff. You'd better get a move on and get Craig back to New York before he slips us again. I'm going to stay here with the others. The inspector sighed. His face had grown long, and the buoyancy had passed from his manner. This is some disappointment, believe me, Miss Laura, he confessed. Cheer up, she laughed. You'll get over it all right. They found the others waiting for them at the end of the great wooden shed. Quest turned to French. Look here, French, he said. You know I don't want to hurry you off, but I don't know what we're going to do with this fellow about in San Francisco. We don't want to lodge two charges, and we should have to put him in jail tonight. Why don't you take him on right away? There's a limited, goes by the southern route in an hour's time. French assented gloomily. That suits me, he agreed. You'll be glad to get rid of that fellow, too, he added. They drove straight to the depot, found two vacant seats in the train, and Quest, with a little sigh of relief, handed over his charge. Craig, who, though still dumb, had shown signs of intense nervousness since the landing, sank back into his corner seat, covering the upper part of his head with his hands. Suddenly Lenora, who had been chatting with French through the window, happened to glance towards Craig. She gave a little cry and stepped back. Look, she exclaimed, the eyes. Those are the eyes that haunted me all through these terrible days. She was suddenly white. Quest passed his arm through hers and glanced through the carriage window. In the shaded light, Craig's eyes seemed indeed to have suddenly grown in power and intensity. They shone fiercely from underneath the hands which clasped his forehead. "Well, that's the last you'll see of them," Quest reminded her soothingly. "Come, you're not going to break down now, Lenora. We've been through it all, and there he is, safe and sound, in French's keeping. There is nothing more left in the world to frighten you." Lenora pulled herself together with an effort. "It was silly," she confessed, "yet even now..." "Don't you worry, Miss Lenora," French cried out from the window. "You can take my word for it, the job's finished this time. Goodbye, all of you. Goodbye, Miss Laura." Laura waved her hand gaily. They all stood and watched the train depart. Then they turned away from the depot. "Now for a little holiday," Quest declared, passing Lenora's arm through his. "We'll just have a look round the city and then get down to San Diego and take a look at the exposition there. No responsibilities, no one to look after, nothing to do but enjoy ourselves." "Capital," the professor agreed, beaming upon them all. "There's a collection of fossilized remains in the museum here, the study of which will afford me the greatest pleasure and interest." The girls laughed heartily. "I think you and I," Quest suggested, turning to them, "will part company with the professor." Quest and Lenora turned away from the window of the hotel, out of which they had been gazing for the last quarter of an hour. Stretched out before them were the lights of the exposition, a blur of twinkling diamonds against the black garb of night. Beyond, the flashing of a lighthouse and a faint background of dark sea. "It's too beautiful," Lenora sighed. Quest stood for a moment shaking his head. The professor, with a pile of newspapers stretched out before him, was completely engrossed in their perusal. Laura, who had been sitting in an armchair at the further end of the apartment, was apparently deep in thought. The newspaper, which she had been reading, had slipped unnoticed from her fingers. "Say, you two are no sort of people for a holiday," Quest declared. "As for you, Laura, I can't think what's come over you. You never opened your mouth at dinner time, and you sit there now, looking like nothing on earth." "I'm beginning to suspect her," Lenora chimed in. "Too bad he had to hurry away, dear." Laura's indignation was not altogether convincing. Quest and Lenora exchanged amused glances. The former picked up the newspaper from the floor and calmly turned out the professor's lamp. "Look here," he explained. "This is the first night of our holiday. I'm going to run the party, and I'm going to make the rules. No more newspapers tonight or for a fortnight, you understand? No reading, nothing but frivolity. And no lovesickness, Miss Laura." "Lovesickness indeed," she repeated scornfully. "Having arranged those minor details," Quest concluded, "on with your hats, everybody. I'm going to take you out to a cafe where they play the best music in the city. We are going to have supper, drink one another's health, and try to forget the last few months altogether." Lenora clapped her hands, and Laura rose at once to her feet. The professor obediently crossed the room for his hat. "I'm convinced," he said, "that our friend Quest's advice is good. We will at any rate embark upon this particular frivolity which he suggests." End of chapter 13, part 1.
Chapter 13, part 2 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. 'Neath Iron Wheels, part 2. Quest took the dispatch, which the hotel clerk handed to him one afternoon a fortnight later, and read it through without change of expression. Lenora, however, who was by his side, knew at once that it contained something startling. "What is it?" she asked. He passed his arm through hers and led her down the hall to where the professor and Laura were just waiting for the lift. He beckoned them to follow him to a corner of the lounge. "There's one thing I quite forgot a fortnight ago," he said slowly, "when I suggested that we should none of us look at a newspaper all the time we were in California. Have you kept our bargain, Professor?"
"Absolutely."
"And you girls?"
"I've never seen one," Lenora declared.
"Nor I," Laura echoed.
"I made a mistake," Quest confessed. "Something has happened which we ought to have known about. You had better read this message, or wait, I'll read it aloud. 2 Sanford Quest, Garfield Hotel, San Diego. Injured in wreck of Limited. Recovered consciousness today. Craig reported burned in wreck, but think you had better come on. French, Samaritan Hospital, Alguez.
"When can we start?" Laura exclaimed excitedly.
Lenora clutched at Quest's arm.
"I knew it," she declared simply. "I felt perfectly certain when they left San Francisco that something would happen. We haven't seen the end of Craig yet."
Quest, who had been studying a timetable, glanced once more at the dispatch.
"Look here," he said. "Alguez isn't so far out of the way if we take the southern route to New York. Let's get a move on tonight."
Laura led the way to the lift. She was in a state of rare discomposure.
"To think that all the time we've been giddying around," she muttered, "that poor man has been lying in hospital. Makes one feel like a brute."
"He's been unconscious all the time," Quest reminded her.
"Might have expected to find us there when he came to, anyway," Laura insisted.
Lenora smiled faintly as she caught a glance from Quest.
"Laura's got a heart somewhere," she murmured. "Only it takes an awful lot of getting at."
They found French already convalescent, comfortably installed in the private ward of a small hospital in the picturesque New Mexican town. Laura, almost at once, established herself by his side.
"You're going to lose your job here, nurse," Quest told her, smiling.
The nurse glanced at French.
"The change seems to be doing him good anyway," she remarked. "I haven't seen him look so bright yet."
"Can you remember anything about the wreck, French?" Quest inquired.
The inspector passed his hand wearily over his forehead.
"It seems more like a dream, or rather a nightmare, than anything," he admitted. "I was sitting opposite Craig when the crash came. I was unconscious for a time. When I came to, I was simply pinned down by the side of the car. I could see a man working hard to release me, tugging and straining with all his might. Every now and then, I got a glimpse of his face. It seemed queer, but I could have sworn it was Craig. Then other people passed by. I heard the shriek of a locomotive. I could see a doctor bending over some bodies. Then it all faded away and came back again. The second time, I was nearly free. The man who had been working so hard was just smashing the last bit of timber away, and again I saw his face, and that time I was sure that it was Craig. Anyway, he finished the job."
I suddenly felt I could move my limbs. The man stood up as though exhausted, looked at me, called to the doctor, and then he seemed to fade away. It might have been because I was unconscious myself, for I don't remember anything else till I found myself in bed.
"It would indeed," the professor remarked, "be an interesting circumstance. An interesting psychological circumstance, if I might put it that way. If Craig, the arch-criminal, the man who has seemed to us so utterly devoid of all human feeling, should really have toiled in this manner to set free his captor."
"Interesting or not," Quest observed, "I'd like to know whether it was Craig or not. I understand that there are about a dozen unrecognizable bodies found."
The nurse, who had left the room for a few minutes, returned with a small package in her hand, which she handed to French. He looked at it in a puzzled manner. "What can that be?" he muttered, turning it over. "Addressed to me, all right. But there isn't a soul knows I'm here except you people. Will you open it, Miss Laura?" She took it from him and untied the strings. A little breathless cry escaped from her lips as she tore open the paper. A small black box was disclosed. She opened the lid with trembling fingers and drew out a scrap of paper. They all leaned over and read together. "You have all lost again. Why not give it up? You can never win. The hands." Lenora was perhaps the calmest. She simply nodded with the melancholy air of satisfaction of one who finds her preconceived ideas confirmed. "I knew it," she exclaimed softly. "I knew it at the depot. Craig's time has not come yet. He may be somewhere near us even now." She glanced uneasily around the ward. Quest, who had been examining the postmark on the package, threw the papers down. "The postmark's all blurred out," he remarked. "There's no doubt about it. That fellow Craig has a devil's own luck. But we'll get him. We'll get him yet. I'll just take a stroll up to police headquarters and make a few inquiries. You might come with me, Lenora, and Laura can get busy with her amateur nursing." "I shall make inquiries," the professor announced briskly, "concerning the local museum. There should be interesting relics hereabouts of the prehistoric Indians." End of chapter 13, part 2.
Chapter 13, part 3 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. 'Neath Iron Wheels, part 3. A man sat on the steps of the range cook wagon, crouching as far back as possible to take advantage of its slight shelter from the burning sun. He held before him a newspaper, a certain paragraph of which he was eagerly devouring. In the distance, the mailboy was already disappearing in a cloud of dust. "Famous criminologist in Augues. Sanford Quest and his assistants, accompanied by Professor Lord Ashley, arrived in Augues a few days ago to look for John Craig, formerly servant to the scientist. Craig has not been seen since the accident to the Limited a fortnight ago, and by many is supposed to have perished in the wreck. He was in the charge of Inspector French and was on his way to New York to stand his trial for homicide. French was taken to the hospital, suffering from concussions of the brain, but is now convalescent." The man read the paragraph twice, then he set down the paper and looked steadily across the rolling prairie land. There was a queer, bitter little smile upon his lips. "So it begins again," he muttered. There was a cloud of dust in the distance. The man rose to his feet, shaded his eyes with his hand, and shambled round to the back of the wagon, where a long table was set out with knives and forks, hunches of bread, and tin cups. He walked a little further away to the fire and slowly stirred a pot of stew. The little party of cowboys came thundering up. There was a chorus of shouts and exclamations, whistlings, and good-natured chaff as they threw themselves from their horses. Long Jim stood slowly cracking his whip and looking down the table. "Say, boys, I think he's fixed up things all right," he remarked. "Come on with the grub, Cookie." Silently, the man filled each dish with the stew and laid it in its place. Then he retired to the background, and the cowboys commenced their meal. Long Jim winked at the others as he picked up a biscuit. "Cookie, you're no good," he called out. "The stew's rotten. Here, take this." He flicked the biscuit,
which caught the cook on the side of the head. For a moment the man started. With his hand upon his temple, he flashed a look of hatred towards his assailant. Long Jim laughed carelessly. "Say, Cookie," the latter went on, "where did you get them eyes? Guess we'll have to tame you a bit." The meal was soon over, and Jim strolled across to where the others were saddling up. He passed his left arm through the reins of his horse and turned once more to look at Craig. "Say, you mind you do better tonight, young fellow, huh?" He stopped short with a cry of pain. The horse had suddenly started, wrenching at the reins. Jim's arm hung helplessly down from the shoulder. "Gee, boys, it's broken," he groaned. "Say, this is hell." He swore in agony. They all crowded around him. "What's wrong, Jim?" "It's broken, sure." "Wrong, you helpless sons of looms," Jim yelled. "Can't any of you do something?" The cook suddenly pushed his way through the little crowd. He took Jim's shoulder firmly in one hand and his arm in the other. The cowboy howled with pain. "Let go of my arm," he shouted. "Kill him, boys. My God, I'll make holes in you for this." He snatched at his gun with his other hand, and the cowboys scattered a little. The cook stepped back. The gun flashed out, only to be suddenly lowered. Jim looked incredulously towards his left arm, which hung no longer helpless by his side. He swung it backwards and forwards, and a broad grin slowly lit up his lean brown face. He thrust the gun into his holster and held out his hand. "Cookie, you're all right," he exclaimed. "You've done the trick this time. Say, you're a miracle." The cook smiled. "Your arm was just out of joint," he remarked. "It was rather a hard pull, but it's all right now." Jim looked around at the others. "And to think that I might have killed him," he exclaimed. "Cookie, you're a white boy. You'll do. We're going to like you here." Craig watched them ride off. The bitterness had passed from his face. Slowly, he began to clean up. Then he crept underneath the wagon and rested. Evening came, and with it, a repetition of his labors. When everything was ready to serve, he stepped from behind the wagon and looked across the rolling stretch of open country. There was no one in sight. Softly, almost stealthily, he crept up to the wagon, fetched out from its wooden case a small violin, and made his way to the further side of the wagon, sat down with his back to the wheel, and began to play. His eyes were closed. Sometimes the movements of his fingers were so slow that the melody seemed to die away. Then, unexpectedly, he picked it up, carrying the same strain through quick, convulsive passages, lost it again, and wandered as though in search of it, extemporizing all the time, yet playing always with the air of a man who feels and sees the hidden things. Suddenly the bow rested motionless. A look of fear came into his face. He sprang up. The cowboys were all stealing from the other side of the wagon. They had arrived and dismounted without his hearing them. He sprang to his feet and began to stammer apologies. Long Jim's hand was laid firmly upon his shoulders. "Say, Cookie, you don't need to look so scared. You ain't done nothing wrong. Me and the boys, we like your music. Sing us another tune on that fiddle." "I haven't neglected anything," Craig faltered. "It's all ready to serve." "The grub can wait," Jim replied. "Pull the bow, partner, pull the bow." The cook looked at him for a moment incredulously. Then he realized that the cowboy was in earnest. He picked up the bow and commenced to play again. They sat around him, wondering, absolutely absorbed. No one even made a move towards the food. It was Craig who led them there at last himself, still playing. Long Jim threw his arm almost caressingly around his shoulder. "Say, Cookie," he began, "there ain't never no questions asked concerning the past history of the men who find their way out here, just so long as I don't play the game yellow. Maybe you've fitted up a nice little hell for yourself somewhere, but we ain't none of us hankering to know the address. You're white, and you're one of us, and any time any guy wants to charge you rent for that little hell where you got the furniture of your conscience stored, why, just let us settle with him, that's all. Now, one more tune, Cookie." Craig shook his head. He had turned away to where the kettle was hissing on the range fire. "It's time you had your food," he said. Long Jim took up the violin and drew the bow across it. There was a chorus of execrations. Craig snatched it from him. He suddenly turned his back upon them all. He had played before, as though to amuse himself. He played now with the complete, almost passionate absorption of the artist. His head was uplifted, his eyes half closed. He was no longer the menial, the fugitive from justice. He was playing himself into another world, playing amidst a silence which, considering his audience, was amazing. They crouched across the table and watched him. Long Jim stood like a figure of stone. The interruption which came was from outside. "More of these damned tourists," Long Jim muttered. "Women, too." Craig had stopped playing. He turned his head slowly. Quest was in the act of dismounting from his horse. By his side was the professor. Just behind, Lenora and Laura. Long Jim greeted them with rough cordiality. "Say, what are you folks looking for?" he demanded. Quest pointed to Craig. "We want that man," he announced. "This is Inspector French from New York. I am Sanford Quest." There was a tense silence. Craig covered his face with his hands, then suddenly looked up. "I won't come," he cried fiercely. "You've hounded me all round the world. I'm innocent. I won't come." Quest shrugged his shoulders. He took a step forward, but Long Jim, as though by accident, sauntered in his way. "Got a warrant?" he asked tersely. "We don't need it," Quest replied. "He's our man, right enough." "Right this minute, he's our cook," drawled Long Jim. "And we ain't exactly particular about going hungry to please a bunch of strangers. Cut it short, mister. If you ain't got a warrant, you ain't got this man. Maybe we don't sport finger bowls and silk socks, but we're civilized enough not to let a slim dude walk off with one of our boys without proper authority. So you can just meander along back where you came from. Ain't that right, boys?" There was a sullen murmur of assent. Quest turned his back and whispered for a moment to the inspector. Then he turned to Long Jim. "All right," he agreed. "The inspector here and I will soon see to that. We'll ride back to the township. With your permission, the ladies and her elderly friend will remain for a rest." "You're welcome to anything we've got except our cook," Jim replied, turning away. Darkness came early, and the little company grew closer and closer to the campfire, where Craig had once more taken up the violin. The professor had wandered off somewhere into the darkness, and the girls were seated a little apart. They had been treated hospitably, but coldly. "Don't seem to cotton to us, these boys," Laura remarked. "They don't like us," Lenora replied, "because they think we're after Craig. I wonder what Long Jim has been whispering to him, and what the paper is he has been showing Craig. Do you know how far we are from the Mexican border?" "Not more than 5 or 6 miles, I believe," Laura replied. Lenora rose softly to her feet and strolled to the back of the range wagon. In a few moments she reappeared, carrying a piece of paper in her hand. She stooped down. "Craig saddling up," she whispered. "Look what he dropped." She held out the paper, on which was traced a roughly drawn map. "That lines the river that marks the Mexican border," she explained. "You see where Long Jim put the cross? That's where the bridge is. The other cross is the camp." She pointed away southward. "That's the line," she continued. "Laura, where's the professor?" "I don't know," Laura replied. "He rode off some time ago. Said he was going to meet Mr. Quest." "If only he were here," Lenora muttered. "I feel sure Craig means to escape. There he goes." They saw him ride off into the darkness. Lenora ran to where her horse was tethered. "I'm going after him," she announced. "Listen, Laura, if they arrive soon, send them after me. That's the line, as near as I can tell you," she added, pointing. "Wait, I'm coming too," Laura exclaimed. Lenora shook her head. "You must stay here and tell them about it," she insisted. "I shall be all right." She galloped off while Laura was still undecided. Almost at that moment, she heard from behind the wagon sound of horses' feet in the opposite direction, and Quest alone galloped up. Laura laid her hand upon his rein. "Where are the others?" she asked. "French and two deputies from the township are about a mile behind," Quest replied. "They've had trouble with their horses." "Don't get off," Laura continued quickly. "Craig has escaped, riding towards the Mexican frontier. Lenora is following him. He's gone in that direction," she added, pointing. "When you come to the river, you'll have to hunt for the bridge." Quest frowned as he gathered up his reins. "I was afraid they'd try something of the sort," he muttered. "Tell the others where I've gone, Laura." He galloped off into the darkness. Behind, there were some growls from the little group of cowboys, none of whom, however, attempted to interfere with him. Long Jim stood up and gazed sullenly southwards. "Cookie'll make the bridge all right," he remarked. "If the girl catches him, she can't do anything. And that last guy will never make it. Whoop, here comes the rest of them." The inspector with two deputies rode suddenly into the camp. The inspector paused to speak to Laura. Long Jim's eyes sparkled as he saw them approach. "It's old Harris and Fat Andy," he whispered. "We'll have some fun with them." The older of the two deputies approached them, frowning. "Been at your games again, Long Jim," he began. "I hear you declined the handover criminal who's been sheltering on your ranch. You'll get in trouble before you're finished." "Got the warrant?" Jim asked. The deputy produced it. Long Jim looked at it curiously and handed it back. "Guess the only other thing you want, then, is the man." "Better produce him quickly," the deputy advised. Jim turned away. "Can't do it. He beat it." "You mean that you let him go?" "Let him go?" Jim repeated. "I ain't got no right to keep him. He took the job on a moment's notice, and he left at a moment's notice. There's some of your party after him, all right." The deputies whispered to one another. The elder of the two turned around. "Look here," he said to the cowboys, glancing around for Long Jim, who had disappeared. "We've had about enough of your goings-on. I reckon we'll take one of you back and see what 7 days of bread and water will do towards civilizing you." There was a little mutter. The deputies stood side by side. With an almost simultaneous movement, they had drawn their guns. "Where's Long Jim?" the older one asked. There was a sudden whirling about their heads. A lariat, thrown with unerring accuracy, had gathered them both in its coil. With a jerk, they were drawn close together, their hands pinned to their side. Two cowboys quickly disarmed them. Long Jim came sauntering around from the other side of the range wagon, tightening the rope as he walked. "Say, you've got a hell of a nerve, butting into a peaceable camp like this. We ain't broke no laws."
"So?
You're going to civilize us, huh? Well, Mr. Harris, we can play the civilizing game, too. Hey, boys, all together, tie him up against that wagon." A dozen willing hands secured them. The two men spluttered wildly, half in anger, half in fear of their tormentors. But in a few seconds, they were secured firmly against the canvas-top wagon. "Now, sit easy, gentlemen, sit easy. Nothing's going to hurt you."
Long Jim
shoved fresh cartridges into his .45. "That is, unless you're unlucky. Line up there, boys, one at a time now. Bud, you and Tim and Doughhead, give them guys a singe. Their hair's getting too long. The rest of you boys, just content yourselves doing a fancy decoration on the canvas all around them. I'll devote my entire attention to trimming those luxurious whiskers Mr. Harris is a sporting. All ready now. 1, 2, 3, let them whistle." The two deputies gave a simultaneous yell as several bullets sung by their ears. "Whoa, old horse," drawled Long Jim. "Flies bothering you some, huh? Sit easy, sit easy. Too dangerous hopping around that way. You might stick yourself right in the way of one of them spitballs. Some nerve tonic, this. AXX Ranch brand. Ready to serve at all hours. Cheap at half the price. Aha. Pretty near shaved your upper lip that time, didn't I, Mr. Harris? My hand's a bit unsteady, and with what all the excitement hereabouts. Say, put a stem on that chrysanthemum you're doing, Cotton Top." The two men racked with fury and terror, ridiculous in their trussed-up state, motionless and strained, crouched in terror, while the bullets passed all around them. Inspector French tapped Long Jim on the shoulder. "Look here," he remonstrated. "You're looking for trouble. You can't treat representatives of the law like this." Long Jim turned slowly around. His politeness was ominous. "Say, you've got me scared," he replied. "Am I going to be hung?" "The law must be respected," French said firmly. "Untie those men." Long Jim scratched his head for a moment. "Say, Mr. Inspector," he remarked, "you're a fine man in your way, but you weigh too much. That's what's the matter with you. Boys," he added, turning around, "what's the best exercise for reducing flesh?" "Dancing," they shouted. Long Jim grinned. He fell back a little. Suddenly, he lowered his gun and shot into the ground, barely an inch from French's feet. The inspector leaped into the air. "Once more, boys," the cowboy went on. "Keep it up, Inspector. Jump a little higher next time. You barely cleared that one." The bullets buried themselves in the dust around the inspector's feet, fuming with anger. French found himself continually forced to jump. The two deputies, forgotten for the moment, watched with something that was almost like a grin upon their faces. Laura, protesting loudly, was obliged more than once to look away to hide a smile. Jim at last slipped his gun into his holster. "No more ammunition to waste, boys," he declared. "Untie the guys with the warrant and bring out the bottle of rye. Say," he went on, addressing the deputies as they struggled to their feet, "and you, Mr. New Yorker, is to be friends and a drink. Or do you want a quarrel?" The deputies were very thirsty. The perspiration was streaming down French's forehead. They all looked at one another. Laura whispered in French's ear, and he nodded. "We'll call it a drink," he decided. The hunted man turned around with a little gasp. Before him was a rude mountain bridge, and on the other side, freedom. Suddenly, A dozen lengths away was Lenora, and close behind her came Quest. He slackened speed as he walked his horse cautiously onto the planked bridge. Suddenly he gave a little cry. The frail structure, unexpectedly insecure, seemed to sway beneath his weight. Lenora, who had been riding fast, was unable to stop herself. She came onto the bridge at half canter. Craig, who had reached the other side in safety, threw up his hands. "Look out," he cried. "My God!" The bridge suddenly collapsed as though it had been made of paper. Lenora, grasping her horse, was thrown into the stream. Quest, galloping up, was only able to check himself just in time. He flung himself from his horse and plunged into the stream. It was several moments before he was able to reach Lenora. From the opposite bank, Craig watched them, glancing once or twice at the bridge. One of the wooden pillars had been sawn completely through. "Are you hurt, dear?" Quest gasped as he drew Lenora to the bank. She shook her head. "Just my side. Did Craig get away?" Quest looked gloomily across the stream. "Craig's in Mexico, right enough," he answered savagely. "But I am beginning to feel that I could fetch him back out of hell." End of chapter 13, part 3.
Chapter 14, part 1 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tongues of Flame, part 1. From the shadows of the trees on the further side of the river, Craig, with strained eyes, watched Quest struggle. He saw him reach Lenora, watched him struggle to the bank with her, waited until he had lifted her onto his horse. Then he turned slowly around and faced the one country in the world where freedom was still possible for him. He looked into a wall of darkness, penetrated only at one spot by a little blaze of light. Slowly, with his arm through the bridle of his horse, he limped towards it. As he drew nearer and discovered its source, he hesitated. The light came through uncurtained windows of a saloon, three long yellow shafts illuminating the stunted shrubs and sandy places. Craig kept in the shadow between them and drew a little nearer. From inside, he could hear the thumping of a worn piano, the twanging of a guitar, the rattle of glasses, the uproarious shouting of men, the shrill laughter of women. The tired man and the lame horse stole reluctantly a little nearer. Craig listened once more, wearily. It was home he longed for so much, and rest. The very thought of the place sickened him. Even when he reached the door, he hesitated, and instead of entering, stood back amongst the shadows. If only he could find any other sort of shelter. Inside, the scene was ordinary enough. There was a long bar against which were lounging half a dozen typical Mexican cowpunchers. There was a small space cleared for dancing, at the further end of which two performers were making weird but vehement music. Three girls were dancing with cowboys, not ungracefully considered the state of the floor and the frequent discords in the music. One of them, the prettiest, stopped abruptly and pushed her partner away from her. "You have drunk too much, Jose," she exclaimed. "You cannot dance. You tread on my feet, and you lean against me. I do not like it. I will dance with you another night when you are sober. Go away, please." Her cavalier swayed for a moment on his feet. Then he looked down upon her with an evil glitter in his eyes. He was tall and thin, with a black mustache and yellow, unpleasant-looking teeth. "So you will not dance any longer with Jose," he muttered. "Very well. You shall drink with him, then. We will sit together at one of those little tables. Listen, you shall drink wine." "I do not want to drink wine with you. All that I wish is to be left alone," the girl insisted curtly. "Go and play cards if you want to. There's Pietro over there and Diego.
Perhaps you may win some money. They say that drunkards have all the luck." Jose leered at her. "Presently I will play cards," he said. "Presently I will win all their money, and I will buy jewelry for you, Marta. Stones that look like diamonds and sparkle in your neck and in your hair." She turned disdainfully away. "I do not want your jewelry, Jose," she declared. He caught her suddenly by the wrist. "Perhaps this is what you want," he cried, as he stooped down to kiss her. She swung her right hand round and struck him on the face. He staggered back for a moment. There was a red flush which showed through the tan of his cheek. Then he drew a little nearer to her, and before she could escape, he had passed his long arm around her body. He drew her to a chair placed by the side of the wall. His left hand played with the knife at his belt. "Marta, little sweetheart," he said mockingly, "you must pay for that blow. Don't be afraid," he went on, as he drew the knife across his leather breeches. "A little scratch across your cheek, so. It is but the brand of your master, a love token from Jose. Steady now, little maverick." The girl struggled violently, but Jose was strong. Such brawls were common, and those of the company who noticed at all merely laughed at the girl's futile struggles. Jose's arm was already raised with a knife in his hand, when a sudden blow brought a yell of pain to his lips. The knife fell clattering to the floor. He sprang up, his eyes red with fury. A man had entered the door from behind and was standing within a few feet of him. A man with long, pale face, dark eyes, travel-stained, and with the air of a fugitive. A flood of incoherent abuse streamed from Jose's lips. He stooped for the knife. Martha threw herself upon him. The two cowboys who had been dancing suddenly intervened. The girl screamed. "It was Jose's fault," Martha cried. "Jose was mad. He would have killed me." Craig faced them all with sudden courage. "As I came in," he explained, "that man had his knife raised to stab the girl. You don't allow that sort of thing, do you hear?" The two cowboys linked their arms through Jose and led him off towards a door. "The stranger's right, Jose," one of them insisted. "You can't carve a girl up in company." The girl clutched at Craig's arm. "Sit down here, please," she begged. "Wait." She disappeared for a moment and came back with a glass full of wine, which she set down on the table. "Drink this," she invited, "and thank you for saving me." Craig emptied the glass eagerly. He was beginning to be more than a little conscious of his fatigue. "I just happened to be the first to see him," he said. "They aren't quite wild enough to allow that here, are they?" "Que sab, the girls do not like me. The men do not care," she declared. "Jose took me by surprise, though, or I would have killed him. But who are you, and where did you come from?" "I have just crossed the border," he replied. She nodded understandingly. "Were they after you?" "Yes, with a warrant for my arrest." She patted his hand. "You are safe now," she whispered. "We care that much for a United States warrant." And she snapped her slim fingers. "You shall stay with us for a time. We will take care of you." He sighed wearily. "If I do," he said, "there will be trouble. Wherever I go, there is trouble. I have been round the world looking for peace. I shall never find it in this world." Her eyes filled with tears. There was something hopelessly pathetic in his appearance. "You shall find it here," she promised. Back in the camp, a spirit of deviltry had entered once more into Long Jim and his mates. A tactless remark on the part of one of the deputies had set alight once more the smoldering fire of resentment which the cowboys had all the time felt against them. At a word from Long Jim, they were taken by surprise and again tied to the wagon. "These guys ain't got sufficiency yet, boys. Limber up them guns again. Same order as before. Put a few more petals on them flowers, and I'll trim their eyelashes for them." The deputies sputtered with rage and fear. Shots rained about them, and the canvas of the wagon was riddled. French began to get restless. "Look here," he said to Laura, "I can't stand this any longer. It doesn't seem right to have two officers of the law treated like that. Anyway, I guess I'll have to butt in again." "Don't," Laura advised bluntly. "You'll get yours if you do." A yell from one of the deputies clinched the matter. French drew his revolver and advanced into the center of the little group. "Say, you fellows," he exclaimed, "you've got to stop this. Those men came here on a legitimate errand, and it's your duty to respect them." Long Jim strolled up to the inspector. "Maybe you're right, Mr. French," he remarked, but with a swoop of his long arm, he had snatched French's gun away, examined it for a moment, looked at French, and shook his head. "You're too fat, Inspector," he declared sorrowfully. "Still too fat. That's what's the matter with you. Another 10 minutes' exercise will do you all the good in the world." A bullet struck the dust a few inches from French's feet. Furious with rage, he found himself once more forced to resort to undignified antics. This time, however, Laura intervened. She walked straight up into the little circle and stood close to French's side, regardless of the leveled guns. "Look here, Long Jim, or whatever your name is," she protested. "You just call your crowd off and stop this. Undo those two deputies. A joke's a joke, but this has gone far enough. If you don't untie them, I will. Take your choice and get a move on." Long Jim scratched his chin for a moment. "Well," he said, "I guess that's what the lady says goes. We ain't often favored with ladies' society, boys, and I guess when we are, we'd better do as we are told. Turn 'em loose, boys." They abandoned the sport a little reluctantly. Suddenly, they all paused to listen. The sound of a horse's slow footfall was heard close at hand. Presently, Quest appeared out of the shadows, carrying Lenora in his arms. Laura rushed forward. "Lenora," she cried, "is she hurt?" Quest laid her tenderly upon the ground. "We had a spill at the bridge," he explained quickly. "I don't know whether Craig loosened the supports. He got over all right, but it went down under Lenora, who was following. I had to get her out of the river. Where's the professor?" The professor came ambling down from the tent where he had been lying. He stooped at once over Lenora's still unconscious form. "Dear me," he exclaimed, "dear me, come, come." He passed his hand over her side and made a brief examination. 4 broken ribs," he pronounced. "It will be a week at any rate before we are able to move her. Nothing more serious, so far as I can see, Mr. Quest, but she'll need rest and all the comfort we can give her." "Say, that's too bad," Long Jim declared. "If you've got to stay around for a time, though, you can have the tents. We boys can double up anywhere or bunk on the ground. That's right, ain't it?" he added, turning round to the cowboys. There was a little grunt of acquiescence. They carried Lenora to the largest of the tents and made her as comfortable as possible. She opened her eyes on the way. "I'm so sorry," she faltered. "It's just my side. It hurts. How did I get out of the stream?" "I fished you out," Quest whispered. "Don't talk now. We're going to make you comfortable." She pressed his hand and closed her eyes again. The professor returned. "We'll make the young lady comfortable, all right," he assured them cheerfully. "But there's one thing you can make up your minds to. We are here for a week at least." They all looked at one another. The inspector was the only one who preserved an air of cheerfulness as he was glancing towards Laura. "Guess we'll have to make the best of it," he murmured. End of chapter 14, part 1.
Chapter 14, part 2 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tongues of Flame, Part 2. The girl drew a low stool over to Craig's side. He was sitting in a rough chair tilted back against the adobe wall of the saloon. As tired as ever, she asked, laying her hand upon his for a moment. He turned his head and looked at her. Always tired, he answered listlessly. She made a little grimace. But you are so strange, she protested. Over the hills, there are the steam cars. They would take you to some of our beautiful cities, where all is light and gaiety. You are safe here, whatever your troubles may have been. You say that you have money, and if you are lonely, she added, dropping her voice, you need not go alone. He patted her hand affectionately, but there was something a little forced about the action. Child, he said, it is so hard to make you understand. I might lose myself for a few minutes, it is true, over yonder. Perhaps even, he added, you might help me to forget, and then there would be the awakening. That is always the same. Sometimes at night I sleep, and when I sleep, I rest. And when my eyes are opened in the morning, the weight comes back and sits upon my heart, and the strength seems to pass from my limbs and the will from my brain. Her eyes were soft, her voice shook a little, as she leaned towards him. Something in his helplessness had kindled the protective spirit in her. Has life been so terrible for you? She whispered. Have you left behind? But no, you never could have been really wicked. You are not very old, are you? Why do you not stand up and be a man? If you have done wrong, then, very likely, people have done wrong things to you. Why should you brood over these memories? Why? What are you looking at? Who are these people? The professor with Quest and Long Jim suddenly appeared round the corner of the building. They walked towards Craig. He shrank back in his place. If these are your enemies, the girl cried fiercely, remember that they cannot touch you here. I'll have the boys out in a minute, if they dare to try. Craig struggled to his feet. He made no answer. His eyes were fixed upon the professor's. The girl passed her arm through his and dragged him into the saloon. They passed Jose in the doorway. He scoffed at them. Say, the boss will fire you, Marta, if you waste all your time with that Yankee, he muttered. Marta drew the red rose from her bosom of her dress and placed it in Craig's buttonhole. Then she led him without a word to a seat. If these men try any tricks in here, she said, there'll be trouble. Almost at that moment, they all three entered. Long Jim nodded to Craig in friendly fashion. It's all right, Cookie, he told them. Don't look so scared. This is just a bit of parley-vous business, that's all. The professor held out a piece of paper. He handed it over to Craig. Craig, he announced, this is a dispatch which I found in Alwes with my letters. It is addressed to you, but under the circumstances you will scarcely wonder that I opened it. You had better read it. Craig accepted the cable form and read it through slowly to himself. To John Craig, care of Professor Lord Ashley, Yonkers, New York. Your sister died today. Her daughter Mary sails on Tuesday to join you in New York. Please meet her. Compton, Solicitor, London. Craig sat for a moment as though stunned. The girl leaned over towards him. Are they trying to take you on a warrant? She whispered. Remember, you don't need to go unless you want to. Craig shook his head. This is something quite different, he explained. Leave me for a moment, Marta. I must talk to these people. She slipped regretfully away from his side and out into the darkness. He sat with his eyes fixed upon the cablegram. Then he turned towards Quest. Fate seems to be too strong for me, he admitted. Leave me alone, and I promise you that I'll go at once to New York, settle Mary's future, and then make a full disclosure. Jim touched him on the shoulder.
Remember, he told him, you ain't no call to leave here unless you want to. These deputies don't go this side of the border. You're safe as long as you like to stay. Craig nodded gratefully. All the same, he said, I fear that I must go. The professor coughed. I'm sure, Craig, he declared, that you have decided wisely. Craig looked gloomily away. There is nothing else for me to do, he said. The child must be met and looked after. Besides, I'm sick of it all. You may as well know the truth. Why not now? Quest suggested softly. In New York, Craig replied, and not before. Quest and the professor exchanged meaning glances. Very well, the former decided, turning away. In a week from today, Craig, I shall expect you to report at the professor's house. They left the room together. Long Jim lingered by Craig's side. Those guys have been scaring you some, I guess, he remarked. Forget 'em, Cookie. They can't touch you here, of course. If you go to New York, it's your own show. I know that, Craig replied gloomily. One of the girls passed her arm through Long Jim's. Just one dance, she whispered. He hesitated, looking out of the window. Then he shrugged his shoulders. I'm tired of those guys, he remarked to Craig with a grin. Guess I'll stay here a bit. Craig was left alone for a few minutes. Suddenly, Marta glided in and sat by his side. Her eyes were flashing with anger. You know what they said, those two, as they passed out? She whispered hoarsely. I heard them. They're going to board the 8:30 train tomorrow morning. The dark man turned and said to the other, if he's not on that, we'll wait till we find him. Once we get him in New York, he's our man. A little exclamation of anger broke from Craig's lips. The girl caught at his arm. Don't go, she begged. Don't go. There are plenty of places near here where you can hide, where we could go together and live quite simply. I'd work for you. Take me away from this, somewhere over the hills. Don't go to New York. They're cruel, those men. They're hunting you. I can see it in their faces. Craig shook his head sadly. Little girl, he said, I should like to go with you along that valley and over the hills and forget that I've ever lived in any other world. But I can't do it. There's a child there now, on the ocean, nearer to New York every day. My sister's own child, and no one to meet her. And there are the other things. I have sinned, and I must pay. My God! The room suddenly rang with Martha's shriek. Through the open window by which they were sitting, an arm, wrapped in a serape, had suddenly hovered over them. Craig, in starting back, had just escaped the downward blow of the knife, which had buried itself in Martha's arm. She fell back screaming. "It's Jose," she cried, "the brute, the beast." Craig swung to his feet furious. Long Jim, cursing fiercely, drew his gun. At that moment the door of the saloon was thrown open. Jose came reeling in, his serape over his shoulder, a drunken grin on his face. He staggered towards them. "Jose, you beast," the girl called out and fell back, fainting. There was a sound of a revolver shot, and Jose reeled backward and fell with a cry across the sanded floor. Jim thrust his smoking gun into his belt and caught Craig by the arm. "Say, we'd better get out of this, Cookie," he muttered. They were hustled out. Apparently Jose was unpopular, for everyone seemed only anxious to have them clear away. "I'll get you into the camp quietly," Long Jim muttered. "You'll be safer there for the night. Then you can make the 8:30 in the morning." Lenora, with her bed dragged to the opening of the tent, eagerly greeted the little party on their return. Quest at once came and sat by her side. "Where's Laura?" he asked, "and the inspector?" She smiled and pointed to the rising ground behind them. In the faint moonlight, two forms were just visible. "The inspector isn't taking no for an answer," Lenora remarked cheerfully, "and honestly, if you ask me, I believe that Laura is weakening a little. She pretended she didn't want to go out for a walk, and mumbled something about leaving me. But she soon changed her mind when the inspector pressed her. They have been up there for an hour or more. Quest smiled. French has got it bad, he declared, almost as badly as I have, Lenora. She laughed at him. Her face was a little drawn with pain, but her eyes were very soft. I wonder if you have it very badly, she murmured. He held her hand for a moment. I think you know, he said. As they talked, they heard the coyotes barking in the distance. Presently, Laura and the inspector returned. Nice sort of nurse I am, the former grumbled. It's all the fault of this man. He would keep me out there talking rubbish. We were watching you, dear, Lenora said quietly. Somehow it didn't seem to us that you were particularly anxious to get away. The inspector chuckled. That's one for Miss Laura, he declared, with an air of satisfaction. Little bit hard on me, generally. Oh, I'm all right if I'm left alone, Laura retorted, bustling around. Come along, you folks, if we're going to have any supper tonight. They sat round the opening before Lenora's tent till the moon was high in the heavens. Quest, who had been on the outside of the circle for some little time, suddenly rose to his feet and crossed over to the cook wagon. Long Jim, who was sitting on the steps, glanced up a little surly. "Who's inside there?" Quest asked. Long Jim removed his pipe from his teeth. "That don't sound no civil a question for a guest," he remarked. "But if you want to know, our new Chinese cookie is there." Quest nodded. "Sorry if I seemed abrupt," he apologized. "You've been very good to us, and I'm sure we are uncommonly obliged to you, Jim." The only reason I asked the question was that I saw a face in the door there, and it gave me a start. For a moment, I thought it was Craig back again. He's gone to New York, or going tomorrow morning. Jim replied, I don't think he's so powerful fond of your company that he'd come around here looking for it. Quest strolled off again and glanced at his watch as he rejoined the little group. Well, he said, I think we'll turn in. 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, Inspector. Jim's sending one of the boys with us, and we shall catch the Eastern Limited at the junction. The inspector yawned. This open air makes me sleepy, he confessed. To bed, all of us, Quest concluded, turning away. End of chapter 14, part 2.
Chapter 14, Part 3 of The Black Box by E. Phillips Oppenheim. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tongues of Flame, Part 3. Quest awoke the next morning, stretched out his hand, and glanced at the watch by the side of his bed. It was barely 6 o'clock. He turned over and dozed again, looking again at 6:30, and finally, a few minutes to 7, rose and made his hasty toilet. Then, in the act of placing his watch in his waistcoat pocket, he gave a sudden start. By its side, half covered by the handkerchief, which he had thrown upon the little table, stood a small black box. For a moment he was motionless. Then he stretched out his hand, removed the lid, and drew out the usual neatly folded piece of paper. Even time fights you. It loses that you may lose. The hands. Quest for a moment was puzzled. Then he hurried into the next tent, where the professor was sleeping peacefully. Say, Professor, what's the time by your watch? Quest asked, shaking him gently. The professor sat up and drew his chronometer from under his pillow. 7 o'clock, he replied. 5 minutes past, maybe. Quest nodded. That seems all right, he declared. I'll explain later, Professor. He hurried out into French's tent and found the inspector just drawing on his shoes. French, what's the time? He demanded. 3 minutes past 7 or thereabouts, French replied, yawning. I'm coming right along. We've lots of time. 3/4 of an hour ought to do it,
the boys say. Quest held out a strip of paper. This gave me a turn, he said quietly. I found it in a black box by the side of my bed. French gazed at it in a puzzled manner. They walked outside to the camp where the cowboys were finishing their breakfast. Say, boss, one of them called out, you're not making that 8:30 train to New York? Why not? Quest asked quickly. It's only 3/4 of an hour's ride, is it? Maybe not, the other replied. But it's 8 now. Your chances ain't looking lively. Kind of overslept, haven't you? Both men glanced once more at their watches. Then Quest thrust his back with a little oath. Our watches have been set back, he exclaimed. The hands again. For a moment they looked at one another, dumbfounded. Then Quest moved towards the corral. Say, is there any quicker way to the depot? He inquired of the cowboys. They heard his question indifferently. $50, Quest continued, to anyone who can take me by a quicker route. One of them rose slowly to his feet. Well, he observed, $50 would come in kind of handy. Yes, I reckon I can cut off a mile or two for you. $50 for you, then, Quest replied, as they hurried towards the horses, and an extra 10 if we make the train. They galloped off into the distance. The cowboys finished their breakfast and went off to their work. Laura stole out of her tent and started off in rather a shamefaced manner for a ride. Presently, Lenora opened her eyes. She, too, stretched out her hand for her watch. Suddenly, she sat up in bed with a little exclamation. On the table by her side was a small black box. She took off the lid with trembling fingers, drew out a scrap of paper, and read, "Fools! Tongues of flame will cross Quest's path. He will never reach the depot alive." Lenora glanced at Laura's empty bed. Then she staggered to the opening of the tent. "Laura," she cried. There was no one there. The cowboys had all gone to their work. Laura had passed out of sight across the ridge in the distance. Lenora staggered to the cook wagon, where the Chinese cook was sitting cleaning plates. "Listen," she cried, "they are in danger, the three men who have gone off to the depot. If you'll ride after them, I will give you $100. Give them this," he added, holding out the scrap of paper. The Chinaman shook his head. He glanced at the slip of paper indifferently and went on with his work. "No can ride, missy," he said. Lenora looked around helplessly. The camp was empty. She staggered across towards her own horse. "Come and help me," she ordered. The Chinaman came unwillingly. They found her saddle, but he only gazed at it in a stolid sort of fashion. "No can fix," he said. "Missy no can ride. Better go back bed." Lenora pushed him on one side. With a great effort, she managed to reach her place in the saddle. Then she turned and, with her face to the depot, galloped away. The pain was excruciating. She could only keep herself in the saddle with an effort. Yet, all the time, that one sentence was ringing in her mind. Tongues of flame. She kept looking around anxiously. Suddenly the road dropped from a little decline. She was conscious of a wave of heat. In the distance, she could see the smoke rolling across the open. She touched her horse with the quirt. The spot which she must pass to keep on the track to the depot was scarcely 100 yards ahead, but already the fire seemed to be running like quicksilver across the ground, licking up the dry greasewood with indeed a flaming tongue. She glanced once behind, warned by the heat. The fire was closing in upon her. A puff of smoke suddenly enveloped her. She coughed, her head began to swim, and a fit of giddiness assailed her. She rocked in her saddle, and the pony came to a sudden standstill, faced by the mass of rolling smoke and flame. "Sanford," Lenora cried, "save me." The pony reared. She slipped from the saddle and fell across the track. End of chapter 14, part 3.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams July Summer Sale and get 30% off paints and stains July 18th through the 28th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.